You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. The passage of the Affordable Care Act has generated concerns that the government will ration valuable health care services. But what exactly is rationing, and how does the U.S. healthcare system allocate scarce resources today? In this podcast, University of Virginia professor Eric Potashnick discusses his research on the politics of evidence-based medicine and why rationing has emerged as a major public policy issue. He covers the roles of doctors, political leaders, and public opinion in shaping the context in which the debate over rationing is playing out. Mr. Potashnick spoke at the February 9, 2011 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Bob McGrath.
It's my honor to introduce our speaker today. And after his talk, I'll be the moderator for the question and answer period that follows. Professor Eric Potashnick is from the University of Virginia, and he wears many hats, and I think we're fortunate that he somehow or other managed to fit us into a very busy schedule. He is professor of politics and public policy at the university, and he's also associate dean at the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration. He received both his master degree in public policy and PhD in political science from the University of California at Berkeley. He's previously held faculty positions at Yale and at UCLA before coming to the University of Virginia. His latest book is called Reforms at Risk: What Happens After Major Policy Changes Are Enacted. This book received the 2009 Brownlow Book Award given by the National Academy of Public Administration. He's found the time to write two other books. One was titled Promoting the General Welfare, New Perspectives on Government Performance, and a second book was titled Putting Trust in the U.S. Budget, Federal Trust Funds and the Politics of Commitment. His many essays have appeared in Political Science Quarterly, Governance, Journal of Health Politics, Policy and Law, Social Service Review, and in many edited volumes. His current research project that he's doing with a collaborator at Yale explores the politics of evidence-based medicine in the United States. The work is supported in part by grants from the Smith Richardson and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Now, his talk today is based on this project, and it's titled, Will We Ration Healthcare? The Coming Public Policy Debate. Now, I think, and I think we'd all agree, that the subject of this talk couldn't be more timely, first of all because of the new healthcare law, but also because I think many people understand that if one way or another the country isn't able to what's called change the cost curve of what it's costing us for healthcare in the United States, that we're never really going to be able to tackle the huge looming deficit and debt problems that the country's facing. So it's all part of a, comes as a parcel, and very, very timely for today. So having said all that, please, let's welcome Professor Eric Pasternak.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here and to see all of you and to talk about an issue that I think concerns all of us who care about not only our own well-being, but the well-being of our loved ones and certainly about our children. And I look forward to your questions and comments. So my talk today is, Will We Ration Healthcare? The Coming Public Policy Debate. And I think this is an issue that has already begun to percolate on the national agenda, but is only going to intensify in the years ahead. And we all recall very recently when there was a debate about the passage of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's healthcare legislation. It was obviously extremely controversial. And one of the most pointed charges that was made by opponents of the bill and made and found, I think, some resonance in the public was that the bill was going to lead to rationing. The idea that the passage of this bill was going to cause people no longer to be able to receive health services they want. And this charge came out in the context of this idea of death panels that I'm sure we've all heard about. There were lots of provisions in the bill that when taken together and either understood or misunderstood or some combination thereof led people to believe that there would somehow be an entity, a body in Washington determining the most basic fundamental question that anyone can face: who shall live and who shall die? And what I want to do today is to try to go beyond that rhetoric and try to think a little bit more about what's going on in our public policy and in our politics, and then also draw a bit on some recent public opinion polls that my colleague Alan Gerber at Yale and I have been doing as part of this project to better understand how American citizens think about these very important issues. So first of all, what do I mean by rationing? Well, rationing is a loaded term, but I think it's an important to try to unpack it and try to think about it very neutrally first. And that is to say that in an economic sense, if you asked an economist, she would say that rationing is simply the process of allocating scarce resources. In a world in which there are many demands, many people that would like many different things, but we have scarcity, not everybody can have everything all the time. And so the question is, how do we decide who gets these scarce resources? And of course, in one sense or another, all valuable goods and services are rationed in some way. 50-yard line tickets at Redskin games? Do any of you have 50-yard line tickets at the Cavalier games? No? They're not worth as much as they used to be, I think, unfortunately. Ski houses at Wintergreen? Any of you perhaps lucky enough to have a ski house at Wintergreen? Well, you know, there's only so many of them to go around, and you have to pay something to have it. Admissions to UVA has also gotten very competitive, and I hope I'm not being broadcast here or anything, but I can say that in the last 48 hours, I have heard from somebody who I have not had contact with in 40 years asking my assistants to help the, let me see if I can tell you this relationship, the daughter of the sister of somebody I went to high school with many years ago, to help this person, who I'm sure is lovely, who I've never met, to get into UVA, because resources are scarce, right? And these are, it's a valuable thing to get that seat. Okay. Now, why is rationing, is a dirty word in healthcare? Why is it something that makes people so upset in healthcare? Well, many Americans regard access to medical care as a basic right, and believe that medical care equals health. The idea is we all want to be healthy, and we think that medical care, having more medicine, more treatment, equals more health. And the reality, of course, is there is some relationship between medical care and health, but it is not a one-to-one relationship. Just because you get medicine doesn't mean you will be healthy, and if you don't have a lot of treatments, you might still be healthy. After all, there are a lot of things that determine your health. Most of all, your genetic makeup, whether you were fortunate or not, and whether you eat right and exercise and have a healthy lifestyle, and whether you're fortunate and lucky, and all sorts of things determine your health besides medical care. So, of course, there's a relationship, but it is not always a one-to-one relationship. But Americans do believe that technology can be a very positive thing, understandably so, the latest medical technology. And many people want unfettered access to the latest treatments. Indeed, Americans believe, on the whole, that decisions about medical care should be made by doctors and patients and no one else. That is a very, very deeply ingrained belief, and an understandable one, for sure. More fundamentally, we think it is wrong to put a dollar value on human life. Some countries approach this. They have policies in place that begin to say, how much is it worth to try to extend a life? We in the United States have been extremely uncomfortable with those reasons. There are a host of cultural reasons, religious reasons, historical reasons why we have been uncomfortable. But the reality, of course, is even if we don't talk about it, we are doing that, right? Every time we make a decision about any public policy, we are making decisions about how valuable a human life is. Why is the speed limit on 29 north not 5 miles an hour? If it were 5 miles an hour, there would be fewer fatalities on 29 North over the next 10 years. We as a society have decided that human life is very valuable, but not so valuable that we don't want to let people drive. And why do we let people skydive? Why do we let people eat bad food? Why do we let people smoke and drink and do all sorts of things that we know is not necessarily very good for them? The answer is because we have other values, such as freedom and liberty and convenience and efficiency and fairness and respect for precedent and all sorts of values. But implicitly, every day, we as a society are making decisions that weigh human life. We just don't do it openly. And in fact, we do ration medical care today. We ration medical care today. How do we do it? We do it implicitly and obliquely. In contrast to other wealthy democracies, we mainly ration on the basis of ability to pay rather than on the basis of need or anticipated benefit. There is, even though we have programs like Medicaid, Medicare, there is still in our system an ability, if you have more resources, to obtain more treatments, other things equal. And we still are very reluctant to allow anybody to say, this particular person cannot have this treatment because we don't believe it's really cost effective. That has been something that we have been very reluctant to do. And what are some of the signs, some of the indicators of the way in which we ration? Well, we know empirically that the uninsured receive less care than the insured. I want to be careful here. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are necessarily less healthy than the insured. There's some debate about how much more health insurance buys, but it is certainly the case that people who have insurance consume, other things equal, more health care than do the people who don't have insurance. So one way we ration services is on the basis of insurance status. We invest less than we should probably in primary care and other services. We have only a certain amount of money that we're willing to spend on health care, and there are some kinds of medicine we don't invest that much in. And many people would argue that we underinvest, for example, in primary care relative to some specialized services. Most importantly, and the way that is least visible, we ration other valuable things to make up for rising healthcare costs. And so let me focus on two of the main ways. Many of you are currently retired or near retirement, and so this first one may be a little bit less salient to you, but I can tell you it is something that affects dramatically working Americans today and working families, even if they don't always realize it. And that is, as healthcare costs go up, workers' salaries stagnate. In particular, economists have found that a 10% increase in health premiums leads to a 2.3% decline in workers' inflation-adjusted wages on average. A lot of workers in the American economy have not been getting salary increases. They feel like they are not getting ahead. They are treading water. They don't have the same feeling that their parents or grandparents had of being better off. Part of what's going on is, in fact, workers' overall compensation is stagnating. But to some degree, what's happening is workers are getting more compensation, but more of that compensation is coming in the form of healthcare benefits than in the form of salary. So they don't quite realize they're in a health plan, their employer is paying 8% more this year, and so their overall compensation that that corporation is giving to that worker has gone up by 8%. The worker doesn't feel it because she still has the same health plan and her paycheck hasn't gone up. That is one of the main ways we are, as a society, rationing scarce resources. We are taking away base salary increases that people otherwise would have had. The second way that we are rationing in response to the rising cost of health services is we are spending less money on other public goods, education, roads, parks, other public goods. What is happening in the state of Virginia, and in fact happening along many, many other states? The single program in state budgets that is growing at the fastest percentage increase is Medicaid. We have less money available to fix the roads in Northern Virginia, which have not been upgraded to account for the dramatic population increase. We have, and I say this obviously as somebody who's not disinterested, we are starving our system of higher education. We are dramatically underfunding it, and that is causing us to put pressure on increasing tuition, although we are still giving a deep discount to in-state students and particularly in-state wealthy students. But the ability of the University of Virginia, for example, and Virginia Tech to do what it wants to do, to be able to offer an education that is every bit as good as Duke and Georgetown and other places, is becoming strained because states around the country are under tremendous pressure to fund Medicaid, and that is leaving less money for other public goods. Maybe this is okay. Maybe we care more about Medicaid, but it's not always clear we're making that choice, right? The pressure to keep funding these relentlessly increasing programs grows. And so if we come to this idea of rationing. Here is Donald Berwick, who is the very it's fair to describe him as both distinguished and controversial. Would both be correct adjectives. He is one of the nation's leading experts on the healthcare system, has done absolutely groundbreaking research, but also has gotten into political trouble for his bluntness, for saying things that one is not allowed to say in Washington. And what he said was, the decision is not whether or not we ration care, the decision is whether we will ration with our eyes open. He has been appointed to head the agency that runs the Medicare and Medicaid program. President Obama was not able to get enough support for him, and so it was a short-term appointment. He's trying to get him appointed on a longer-term basis, remains to be seen. But he said baldly what neither elected officials, Democrats nor Republicans, want to really have this conversation. And so here is the coming public policy debate that we will be facing in the years ahead. Are we going to explicitly ration care? Here's an editorial cartoon that is saying, is this what's going to come to? You know, you're going to have to take a number. They're now treating number only 09 and your number 94,275. That's going to be a long wait. And this is obviously everybody's worst nightmare and everybody's fear. And indeed, explicit rationing, when we do this openly, when we do what Mr. Berwick would like us to do in a way, to have an adult conversation about the fact that in a world of scarce resources, tough choices have to be made. It doesn't go so well. It does not go over very well. A number of years ago, the state of Oregon said they were going to try to do two things at once. They were going to try to cover more people under their Medicaid program, and Medicaid's a jointly run state-federal program, the program for low-income persons, not to be confused with Medicare. And they said that we have a lot of people in our state who don't have health insurance, and we want to find a way to give them a basic package. But in order to do that, we have to make some choices because we want to be fiscally responsible. So we're going to ration care by creating a ranking of services and what the highest priority ones. That scheme fell apart. It fell apart from pressure from both doctors, who didn't like it very much, as well as patients. There was gaming from providers, as well as interest group pressure when something was denied to put that particular service back on the covered list. And here's really the rub of it. We need to be open here, and because we can like something or not like something, but we need to talk about what this really, really means. What it really means, explicit rationing, is that some people who are accustomed to getting pretty much whatever care they want would either be denied care or would have to pay more for it out of their own pockets. That's what it means. So explicit rationing, if we did that in a way, would, if we did it through the Medicare program, if we did it through the Medicaid program, if we did it through federal regulation, is inevitably going to increase the role of government. And of course, the problem for this is most Americans, probably including most people in this room, don't trust government very much. We don't live in a society when a politician who's knocking on your door and says, hello, I'm here to help, we usually don't believe them. And if you feel that way, not to worry, you are not alone. Here is a graph that looks at the percentage of Americans who would say, the question is, do you trust the government in Washington to do the right thing always or most of the time? Do you usually trust government in Washington to do the right thing always or most of the time? And if you can see back in the 1950s, 7 in 10 Americans said, yes, I do. I do trust Washington to do the right thing. And one can think about a variety of reasons why trust in government was so high back then. After all, we had just won World War II. We were the strongest democracy. We had peace and prosperity at home. Lots of good reasons. And trust in government has gone up and down some over time, and political scientists and some of my colleagues have made a cottage industry about trying to explain every wiggle on that graph. And, it goes up like one of the ironies was it actually goes up under Ronald Reagan, who was anti-government and a perfectly good reason. Times were good, and he said that he was going to cut taxes and increase defense, and he did it. And so people believed him, and trust went up, even though in some ways he was running against Washington. Trust in government went up after 9/11 when we were under attack. A lot of Americans rallied around government. But the big picture, you leave aside those ups and downs, those little particular episodes, the big picture is a secular trend down. Over the last 30, 40 years, 50 years, most people today, in fact, do not trust government to do the right thing. And that makes any discussion of an increased role of government in healthcare very problematic. This would not be a problem if we were not facing a crisis. But we are. This is a chart that shows the federal debt held by the public, the most important measure, as a share of GDP. And what you can see is today, where we are in 2011, but where it is going, the dotted line at the end of the chart to the right. The federal debt as a share of our economy, if we don't do something, is approaching levels that virtually every expert believes would cause a financial crisis of the first order magnitude in the United States. This would be a crisis that would dramatically impair our economy, our living standards, employment. It is something that is literally not sustainable. We cannot continue on the path we are on. And there is only two ways to address it: raising taxes or lowering spending. Even if we increase economic growth, which I hope we will, that will help some, but restoring economic growth is not enough to deal with this problem. We have fundamentally in this country made spending promises that are greater than our political willingness to pay for them. And no programs are growing faster in the budget than the healthcare programs, because medical inflation has been growing much faster than general inflation for a very long time. So that is the rub. We don't like the idea of rationing. We don't trust government, but we are now coming up against a crisis that will affect certainly my children and their children if we don't do something in the relatively near term. Indeed, the director of the Congressional Budget Office states very clearly, putting the federal budget on a sustainable path would almost certainly require a significant reduction in the growth of federal health spending relative to current law, including this year's health legislation. One can debate whether the health care bill will tame costs some or increase costs some, and the two parties do disagree about that. And I think the honest answer is we don't know, and one can make a good argument either way. But one, what one cannot say is that the health care reform bill solved our health care cost crisis. That, for sure, it did not do. We are facing this crisis, for sure. And here are a couple of more graphs that are really, I think, remarkable. Because what they show, and what many Americans do not realize, is just how much more we spend on health care than other very rich countries like Canada, the Netherlands, Germany, and so on. The graph on the left shows that in 2004 or 5, the United States was spending per capita, per person, something like $7,200 per person on healthcare, where the European countries were spending $3,000 per capita. We are spending a lot more on healthcare, not a little bit more, dramatically more, dramatically more. And if you look as a share of the economy, you might say, well, yeah, but we're richer, right? We can afford to do this. We are sharing a much higher percent, and it is now approaching something like 16% of GDP goes to healthcare, much more than in European democracies. This might be okay if we unambiguously had by far the best healthcare system in the world. We do not. We have some things that are the best. There are definitely some conditions that you would, if you, God forbid, get it, you will thank your lucky stars you are an American because you would only want to be treated here. But that is not generally the truth. There are many conditions that if you had it, you'd be perfectly fine being in Germany or France or Canada because the healthcare there is very good. And this is a study by the Commonwealth Fund. And what it shows is looking on a variety of measures, quality of care, effective care, safe care, coordinated care, patient-centered care, cost-related problems, timeliness of care, efficiency, equity, also how long we live, right? That's pretty important too. You cannot make the case easily that yes, the United States is paying a lot more, but our healthcare outcomes are dramatically better. It would be a hard argument to make. You might be able to make the case that in some areas, maybe we are a little better. But if you look overall, we certainly don't look much better than our competitors. We are spending a lot more. And it is not always clear that we're getting a lot more out of our healthcare system. And in fact, we face what many experts argue is the over-treatment problem. Total spending on healthcare in the United States no doubt has benefits. If we eliminated all healthcare spending to zero, that would be a bad thing. Or even cut it in half, or three quarters probably, that would be a bad thing. It's not that we're not getting any healthcare benefits, of course we are. Nonetheless, on the margin, when we think about going from 16% of GDP to 17% of GDP, of healthcare spending, it is not always clear that we're getting a lot of additional health benefits in return. Because the benefits of some treatments, some tests, some drugs, some procedures for some people are small or even zero, and in some cases negative. Because sometimes we give people drugs or treatments or procedures and their side effects are worse than the benefits. So it happens every day. We do a lot of MRIs, joint replacements, cardiovascular procedures, and back surgeries, even though much evidence suggests they are not always the best way to help patients. Now, I need to give my very important caveat here, which is I am not talking about every condition. I am not talking about every patient. I'm not saying that I'm not somebody who doesn't believe in Western medicine or doesn't take my kids to the doctors, and I'm not one of those people who doesn't inoculate my kids. I want all these things. I just think it's important for people to recognize the trade-offs, the costs and the benefits. So if we know that we are spending a lot of money on healthcare and that the benefits are not always apparent, we should be able to find some way of reducing costs. That's my dad calling, who works in the healthcare industry. He's part of the problem, probably. Actually, he may be actually part of the problem. But he's a very nice guy. We should find a way to reduce spending on healthcare, and to do so in a way without compromising public health. But people understandably worry. Remember, people don't trust government. If you get the government in there that's trying to tame healthcare costs, they worry that efforts to reduce costs are going to increase the risk that some individuals won't receive some care that they want or need. And we all remember this controversy, right, that happened over the change in mammogram guidelines, trying to say that certain women shouldn't get mammograms because it really wasn't a cost-effective screening, and the number of people that would be found who would have extra cases of breast cancer that would be identified at that particular stage, and how many lives would be saved. It was not really very many if you give it to younger women, right? That did not go over very well. The idea that maybe we need to tell some people, you know what? That screening test isn't worth it for you if you're 35 years old. Your probability of getting that disease is not high enough that it's worth screening every 35-year-old American. Or on the other side, that 90-year-old maybe shouldn't get that $400,000 procedure. That's the other side that we also have a difficulty, because is it worth it to give it to that procedure if that person is 95? I don't know. It's not for me to say. It's for us as a community to say. And different people are going to have different views on that. So what we have, though, is what, and this came up in the healthcare debate, was this idea of maybe there's some low-hanging fruit. Maybe there's some things that we can identify that should be relatively easy, one would hope, to trim the costs of. And one thing we do know is that in this vast country, some parts of the country spend a lot more money on healthcare than other parts of the country. So we're not comparing the U.S. to France, we're not comparing the U.S. to England, just the United States. And we know that, for example, Medicare spends $71,000 per end-stage patient in Miami, but only $33,000 in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and there's no evidence that the patients in Green Bay are getting worse medical care than those in Miami. Hospital stays in Green Bay were 25% shorter than the national average, didn't have worse outcomes. One could say, well, the people in Green Bay, they're healthier, you know, they're not like the people in Miami. All the efforts to try to control for all those factors still show big geographical differences. Some areas of the country spend a lot more than other parts of the country, and their patients don't seem to do any better. So that has been something that people have been very concerned about. And what we also know is that there's not, in some areas of medicine, there's not a lot of consensus among doctors about the best way to treat a particular condition. In some areas, the doctors might do a lot of very high-tech, invasive, expensive procedures, but people with the exact same condition might be treated very differently in another part of the country. And that varies by condition. So, for example, what you see here is if you look at hip fractures on the left, that's very tight. That means doctors have very strong consensus. No matter where you live, in the United States, almost all doctors will agree on what the best medicine is for you if you have a hip fracture. Doctors think we know what you have to do when somebody has a hip fracture. If you go all the way to the other side for back surgery, there's no consensus. If you have a back pain, if you live in some parts of the country, they'll do surgery on you. And if you live in other parts of the country, they won't do surgery on you. It really depends on where you live and what the doctors in that community recommend. And if you live in the community that gets the back surgery, that's going to cost Medicare a lot of money. and not there's no evidence for, and again, it's going to depend a lot on the condition, and the back surgery even is, you know, too broad a term. We really have to talk about particular conditions, particular patient groups, and so on. But the point is that sometimes the lay public doesn't think the doctors all agree about everything. And the answer is they agree a lot about some conditions, and they don't agree at all about other conditions. And we have this problem called the medical evidence gap that here Business Week and was covering several years ago. And the dirty little secret is, and this came up some in the debate, many treatments have never been rigorously treated to see if they work better than alternatives. There's several different ways to treat prostate cancer, for example. And you may go to your doctor and hope that none of you will face this. But there are different options. We don't know as much as we should about which one is best. And one can repeat that same one, that same finding over and over again. In lots of areas of medicine, we don't know what's best. A lot of medical research also focuses on proxy measures rather than ultimate health outcomes. What do I mean by that? There might be a drug, for example, that's supposed to be good for preventing you from having a second heart attack. You've had a heart attack, you go on a drug, and we don't want you to have another heart attack. What we really want to know is, how long are you going to live if you're on this drug? Are you going to have a second heart attack? But sometimes we don't have that information. We just know, if you take this other drug, well, will that lower your blood pressure or your cholesterol? Because we think that's related to your probability of having a second heart attack. But it's not the same thing as whether you knowing hard information about that probability. And that is true for lots of information. We don't always know whether drugs actually increase longevity or really increase the thing that we care about. Sometimes we only know what does it do to people who take this drug on some test that we think is related to that ultimate outcome. But sometimes the connection can be very loose. Right? And we might be giving people a lot of medicine and their test scores turn out to be better, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to live longer, which is what we really want to know because we want to help people. Okay. And let me just give you one example to illustrate. And this is a stark example, but it's illustrative of the kind of thing that can and does happen in medicine. So a lot of people, some seniors who have osteoarthritis of the knee, very common thing, sometimes have surgery for that. And again, I'm talking about a particular condition, and they'll have a knee arthroscopy or lavage when physical therapy and other kinds of treatments fail. And this has got to be a fairly common procedure for osteoarthritis of the knee. Well, the question was, does that surgery actually work? A lot of doctors were doing it, and Medicare was paying for it. But we really didn't know whether that surgery worked. So a couple of years ago, 2002, the premier journal of medicine, New England Journal of Medicine, published a blockbuster study. And what they did was, in the study, they gave some people the surgery. And the people who got the surgery felt better, less pain, and they walked better. Their function was better. So that looks pretty good. But the study also gave some people in the study a fake operation where the surgeon did not operate. The surgeon merely made a small incision in the knee and closed it right up. And the patient didn't know. The patient knew that he was in a trial and might get this. He had the whole, you know, it was ethical and had to sign away, I understand I'm in a trial and I might not get the real thing. So it was, but the patient didn't know. And the patients who got the sham operation, the placebo operation, felt better and walked better. There was no difference. So we're all familiar with a sugar pill. Surgery can be a sugar pill for pain, for example. Not for everything, but for pain. There's evidence that the mere fact of undergoing a procedure can cause people, that is, it is a very powerful documented effect, very real. It is not the case that people are lying. They do feel better. They are walking better. But the mechanism by which they're better is not because we actually had the proper medical understanding about how to fix the knee. We didn't. So this was a blockbuster study, and what we found was that the doctors who were doing that surgery kept on doing it because they said, my patients are better. And Medicare tried to defund the surgery some because they said, we're not so sure we should be using taxpayer money to pay for this. But what happened? Inevitably, all the surgical groups lobbied Congress. And to say, no, because this has to be professional judgment and the government should be making these decisions. This is where the rubber meets the road. And so we're still spending money on this procedure. So one solution to this problem is what is called as comparative effectiveness research. And that's just a fancy word that says we should do research, scientific research, that compares treatment A versus treatment B. We should know whether that surgery works better than a fake operation. We should know if watchful waiting is better than radiation therapy for prostate cancer. We should know if stents, coated or uncoated, are better for heart. We need to answer these questions. So the recent legislation, the stimulus bill, and the Obama healthcare bill included some funding for this. And perhaps down the road, one option that we could be looking at as a society is to try to use this research to try to control healthcare costs. But what my colleague Alan Gerber and I wanted to know was, what does the American public think about this idea? And what we see in short is that the public grasps that there is a problem, but is very skeptical of anything that they believe will reduce choice or interfere with the patient-doctor relationship. And this is just a long summary from the Institute of Medicine about what this whole effort is all about. It just says comparative effectiveness research would provide an opportunity to improve the quality and outcomes of healthcare by providing more and better information to support decisions by the public, patients, caregivers, blah, 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 about, you know, trying to figure out what works. That's what this is about. What medicine works the best? Okay. And what we found was that if we asked the public, how do you feel about setting up some kind of board that would have doctors and different people on there, government and other people on there, to issue guidelines that doctors would have to follow? So, for example, in that knee surgery case, the board might say, we will not pay for that surgery unless maybe there's some particular very narrow exception. But generally, we're not going to pay for it for those particular patients. What does the public think about this? You know, they're not wildly enthusiastic about it, okay? And what's behind this public skepticism? What we see, and what any effort to control healthcare costs is going to have to deal with, is there's strong faith in modern medicine. We have strong belief in doctors and the medical profession. And even though trust in many institutions has been going down, including it's gone down for doctors too over the last 30 years, doctors still rank near the top among all the institutions that are most trusted in society. The two institutions that are trusted the most in American society is medicine and the military establishment. Everybody else has gone down quite a bit. Certainly government, big business, unions, media, Congress, scientists, you ask about them, it's all gone down. And they've all gone down some, but the military and medicine has held up the best. And if we look here, you know, if you ask, well, why do people live longer today than 75 years ago? I think most experts would say there's a host of reasons why that is, right? Just think about your lifestyle compared to your grandparents' lifestyle and how much easier and more pleasant it is in most ways, right? But if we ask Americans, most Americans attribute greater longevity to improvements in quality of medical care as opposed to dietary improvements, reductions in pollution, sanitation, or decrease in the smoking rate. People think people are living longer. Medicine is the reason. We also see that people believe in the power of modern medicine. People tend to think that recent innovations are more effective than innovations 10 or 20 years ago. The reality is sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes a new medicine is better. Sometimes a new medicine is just the exact same old one with a new advertising campaign. In fact, most of the new drugs that are coming on the market are basically repackaged old ones with new names and new campaigns. And the drug companies have actually placed, I believe it's the case, you know, a tremendous amount of money in advertising. And it's not the case that drug companies are funneling all their money back into research and development. A lot of it is just going on those TV ads, you see. Okay. Here's another thing. And this is a weird one. And I give my colleague credit for this. Is sometimes in order to understand what the American public thinks, you've got to try to ask questions that are going to tap into their what they really think. Americans, I've already mentioned, really believe in medicine, but they're skeptical of drug companies. And there's a certain amount of kind of anxiety and paranoia out there in the public. And indeed, 68% of Americans think that drug companies are keeping cures secret in order to protect their profits. So that drug companies keep cures for cancer and heart disease secret to protect their profits. So Americans sort of think, you know, there really is a cure of cancer out there. Maybe. But maybe those drug companies are, you know, not telling us it because they want us to buy all their expensive cancer drugs. But they could cure it. We really do believe, a lot of Americans believe, that the cure is just around the corner. And indeed, 56% of Americans believe that modern medicine can cure almost any illness with advanced technology and treatment. That's a pretty high percentage that think medicine can cure anything. Okay. We also see, remember when I mentioned what happened when that study was done about the ineffectiveness of that knee surgery? What would we hope would happen? If doctors were really behaving the way, and I want to be clear, in fact, I had my physical today, and I love my doctor. He's a wonderful guy. And some of my best friends are doctors, and some of you are doctors. I don't mean to trash doctors. But if doctors as a collective were totally upholding the public good, what would we have hoped to see in the aftermath of that knee surgery study? You would have hoped to have seen, well, first of all, the guy who did the study should have gotten some kind of award or something for doing this. No, he was blackballed, okay? He was treated like the skunk at the party. Secondly, you would have hoped, some doctors would have said, my God, this is unbelievable. We're doing these surgeries and there's just a placebo. I can't believe this. That did not happen. The third thing that could have happened is if there were doctors who truly believed the study was flawed, and no study is perfect. I will say this is one of the best medical studies ever done. But no study is perfect. If they had thought the study was flawed, the correct thing for them to do was to say, we don't believe these conclusions. We think there's something wrong with this study. We better do some more studies. We better get on this case. We owe it to the American people to do 5 more of these studies and see if we can replicate this result and make sure this is accurate. Maybe there's a fluke. Maybe they screwed up. That did not happen either. Doctors treated it like somebody else's problem to figure that out. The groups, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and others that fought this, acted as if, in this case, their main function was to kind of protect the revenue flow to them. Now, many of them, I'm sure, sincerely believe that the surgery does help. You could not operate if you did not truly believe that you were helping patients. I do not believe that doctors try to do things they don't think are going to help patients. But it is very difficult to be totally open to the evidence if you have an incentive to do the procedure as well. Okay? But what we see here in the American public is the public does not view doctors or medical groups as economic actors at all. They don't really view them as actors that are motivated at all, even unconsciously, by economic incentives. They believe that doctors are mostly about promoting patient health. The idea that groups, these medical societies, or ever care about maintaining incomes for doctors in that specialty ranks very low. Again, we love doctors. We love doctors. And so the idea that doctors' groups are not always about figuring out what works, that's not something that resonates with the American public. People don't assume that. What we do see is that the American public like some uses of comparative effectiveness research, but not others. So do they want more information about whether a given treatment would work better than alternative ways of treating patients with the same condition? Would you all like more information? Of course you would. Who wouldn't want more information? We all want to know what works. And in fact, most people say yes. Would people like to see warning labels for treatments that are not supported by strong evidence? Yes, they'd like to see that. Now, when you start to get to issues of Medicare coverage, now it gets to be difficult. Are people comfortable with the idea that we should use these studies, like the NICE study that I told you about, to determine whether Medicare and private insurers will cover new treatments that have just become available? Only half the public is comfortable with that. What about determining what groups of patients should be protected from budget cuts in Medicare? Only a third. And finally, what about charging a patient more to get a treatment that research has shown not to be effective, even if their doctor recommends it? So let's say your doctor says, I want you to have this treatment, but there's been a very rigorous study that says this does not work. And so the insurance company says, you can have it, but you have to pay more for it. That's our way of controlling costs. Only 15% of the public support that idea. The idea that the government might say, you have to pay a little bit more to get a treatment that we're not so sure is effective, does not win a ringing endorsement from the public. Okay, and what are people really afraid of? People are afraid of rationing and one-size-fits-all medicine. This idea of treatment guidelines. Here are the arguments that people agree with for reasons. We ask people, here are some reasons why you might want to have these guidelines, and here are some reasons why not. And you see, some people do see this idea that doctors are affected by economic incentives, or that doctors in a given geographical region might not be aware that better treatments are used elsewhere. You do see some support there. But what I want to highlight to your attention is when we look at the treatments against, the arguments against those guidelines, not only is there more opposition, but the intensity is much higher. The red bar is what percentage of people are very convinced by this, okay? And you see that, the blue you see is much, the blue line, the blue bar in the bottom is much longer than the blue bars at the top. More people strongly believe the following: no outside group should come between doctors and patients in making treatment decisions. Doctors will be unable to tailor care to the needs of individual patients if you have these guidelines. And that the government insurance companies are just going to use these guidelines as a way to control costs and ration care. So people are very afraid of anything that's going to get between them and their doctor. There is also a sharp partisan divide on comparative effectiveness research. And this, I think, is both interesting, disappointing, unsurprising, and important. Comparative effectiveness research, the idea that we don't know enough about what works and that a lot of medical spending could be inefficient, was not a Democratic idea. It was not a Republican idea. It was an idea of a bipartisan idea that came from experts associated with both parties, leading health economists associated with the George H.W. Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, the Bill Clinton administration, and the Obama administration, all think this is a problem, all of them. The problem was, and it's not shocking, that the debate over Obama's health care bill, which was mostly a debate about insurance and the uninsured, this whole issue got wrapped up in it. And the Obama administration put the money in there for this stuff and wrapped it all in one gigantic, huge package. And they did it probably because they thought that was an easier way to ram the whole thing through. And maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong. We'll see how the whole thing plays out. But one consequence of that decision was to make this issue, which had not been a partisan issue, become a more partisan issue. Because in attacking the bill, a lot of conservative voices were looking at all aspects of the bill. And so what we see is that there was no partisan divide in support for this among the public generally. But if you look at the people who vote, the people who pay more attention to politics, there you see the Democrats are much more supportive than independents, who are in turn are more supportive of Republicans about this kind of research. And that's because in the whole debate about health reform got an ideological valence, and this just got folded into that larger debate. It just became part and parcel of it. And this is where we are, obviously. The issue has become extremely, extremely partisan. And that is going to make it even more difficult for us as a country to face these issues. Because the reality is, neither Democrats nor Republicans in Washington are really willing to talk about taking any service away from anybody. And the only real way, in my view, that we're ever going to control costs is in a bipartisan way. We need both parties to work together. And as long as the issue is partisan, it's going to be very, very difficult. We don't know if health reform is going to stick, right? We don't know if this bill is going to last. Many of the benefits of the reform are backloaded. The public, I think, is still not sold on the reform. If you compare the politics of the health care reform bill to other big legislation, it's, in my view, very different than Social Security or Medicare was. We've obviously seen court cases coming out against the constitutionality, for sure the individual mandate, but even one decision about the entire bill. So we don't yet know. The final chapter has not been written on this legislation. But what we do know, no matter what happens with this legislation, the problem of rising healthcare costs is not going away. The bill could last, the bill could be repealed. Either way, that problem is going to be here for the next 30 years. So to conclude, what are some of the challenges we're facing in the years ahead? Well, right now, the federal government is beginning to invest billions of dollars in this research to try to figure out what works. But it's become highly politicized. It is not seen just as a neutral scientific exercise. There's also a lot of restrictions on how the research can be used. At some level, the whole point of the research really is, if we're going to be honest, is to use the research to stop paying for stuff that doesn't work very well. But the bill itself says you can't do that. You can do the research, but you actually can't use the information from the research to make any decisions about paying for stuff. So until we cross that divide, it's not going to do anything to control costs. Okay? Another challenge we face is giving patients facts about the benefits and risks of treatments. There is some evidence that patients will actually opt for less invasive care on average than doctors do if they're given full information about the trade-offs in different procedures. Patients might say, you know what, I don't want that surgery for this particular, sometimes, and that could be an individual decision. But there is some evidence, actually, that doctors on average push more invasive treatments on patients than some patients would choose to take. The big problem that's going to be very hard is the underlying economic incentives in our healthcare system are completely messed up and distorted. And of course, the big problem is the fee-for-service system that pays people for doing more interventions and not necessarily for making people better. So that's a fundamental problem. We also have federal tax laws that encourage people arguably to have too much insurance and to consume medical care with marginal benefits. You know, for a lot of times you have health insurance, you're not paying for it out of pocket. The copay might be pretty low and you're not paying for it. What do you care? You'll go in. I'm as guilty as anyone else on that. You know, do I think every time I go to the doctor, is this really necessary? No, I don't think very much about it because the incentives for me to think about it are pretty minimal, actually. And the 2010 health reform law only takes modest steps towards changing these incentives. But these distortions are not going to go away. Now, another idea that my colleague and I tested was, what if instead of using sticks, we use carrots as a way of improving the healthcare system? So let's link this study information to rewards rather than penalties. And we asked people, what if you opt for following these guidelines, you'll get like a rebate from your insurance company at the end of the year. If you sort of say, you know, I'm going to consume healthcare in line with the Institute of Medicine's guidelines, and if it's like being a good driver or something, I'm going to be a good patient, right? If you did that, you'll get an extra check at the end of the year. And actually, people like that a bit more than they would this idea of what about making you pay more for an expensive treatment. It's both, they're just two sides of the same coin. It's using dollars to try to incentivize people's behavior. But people like rewards better than they like penalties. Okay, the other thing, and here we come to the part where I have no expertise whatsoever, and it is just putting it out for food for thought, and that is, at some level, this is an economic problem, but it's also a social and moral and religious issue that is not one that economists can decide. It's one for the American people to decide. And that is, what medical interventions are appropriate, including end-of-life care? Because we know 25% of Medicare spending, for example, goes for 5% of patients in the last year of life. Different people are going to have different moral judgments on whether that's appropriate. It is very difficult for anybody to make a decision, except we are right now making a decision, right, that this is okay. Because how's Medicare paid for? It's paid for by payroll taxes and general fund taxes. So we right now are deciding it's okay to put those taxes on working people and their kids. This is a morally sensitive and politically dangerous subject. And so a question we need to think about is how can we meet the needs of terminal patients in a way that is responsive to individual patient preferences, but also fiscally sustainable for nation? And here I think we're going to need the insight not only of physicians and scientists, but ethicists, clergy, and communities. So with that, I will look forward to your questions.
So thank you very much, Eric. I'm sure there are lots of questions. The rules here are you have to use the microphone. And these gentlemen circulating around will see you if you raise your hand and then use the microphone, please. That's because this is all recorded and people can listen to it afterward. So, just call on people that have a microphone.
Yes.
With the 25% of Medicare spending on 5% of patients in the last year, is that for hospice care?
I think it's everything total, I believe.
Okay.
Everything total.
Thank you.
A follow-up to that as a nurse, as well as having aging parents who have passed away. This is a chronic problem we see throughout the healthcare system. One, either lack of preparation by the physician to educate the family appropriately, or else the family is such a mindset that do anything, everything, keep them alive and one more day has nothing to do with quality of care as it is quantity of care, as well as excessive use and abuse of our resources that we as a nation are going to have to face, especially with our aging population and with the baby boomers rapidly running right in behind all of us. So I'm not sure at what point we can ever stop to think our way through this or look at the resources that hospice and palliative care offer up for dying with dignity versus what you watch so many of these people having nothing left other than being full of tubes and needles as their life ends.
Address anything about the lawyers in the suits.
Yeah.
Nothing was addressed in that. Now, that's one of the main costs of Medicare. My grandson is a resident. They're paying more to insurance than they're paying him.
Yeah.
And all these tests you're talking about that are necessary, most of those are done to protect the doctor, because when it comes to suits, how come you didn't address that, and what's your answer?
I completely agree that that is part of the syndrome. And it is part of it. It is difficult to measure how much that malpractice problem is contributing to this. But for sure, it's significant. And I absolutely agree that we do need malpractice reform. And I think that will happen eventually as part of it. I don't think it's the primary thing. I think the primary thing is the fee-for-service system, the fact that doctors are paid directly for more interventions. But and economists have tried to measure what percentage of the costs are due to that. Most experts believe it's less than people believe, that it's there, that it is a problem, and it's a particular problem in some medical specialty areas. For some doctors' groups, the insurance cost of medical malpractice for them is actually a big burden, I mean a dramatic burden. But in terms of an overall contributor to our healthcare costs, most experts believe it's less than people believe, but that's no reason not to address it. Because it could be wrong. It could be a bigger contributor, and it's for sure a part of the problem. So, you know, I was disappointed that that's not been something that President Obama and the Congress hasn't been able to work out. I think that it's an issue that should be addressed. I don't see any argument against it. Right. Yep.
This sort of piggybacks on that question to a certain extent, and that's as far as the liability today is concerned.
Yeah.
Government today has suddenly taken a change on that position. They've gotten to the point where Obama has actually stated, we've got to study a little bit about how we can remove this tremendous litigious situation.
Yeah.
And so that's a step in the right direction. I would like to point out that in France, for example, we have followed a large part of the French system of health care. We have eliminated one thing they have in theirs, and that is they have limited liability. Mm-hmm. You can only get so much for whatever happens to you.
You know, I think part of what's going on here is this is a defect of our politics, is that sometimes there's an issue that matters more to one party, but the president would be willing to agree to it, for example. But they don't want to make the deal because they want to hold out for some other concessions on some other issues that they care about. So I actually think that Obama, and you're going to have difficulty with Democrats in Congress because of they're supported by trial lawyers, frankly. But I think Obama would be part of a deal on significant malpractice reform. And he's used, some of his rhetoric has been okay. He hasn't pushed for it very hard. And I think it's because he wants a sort of grand bargain and to get other stuff he wants. And that's unfortunate. You know, if Obama and the Republicans can reach a deal on that, they should reach a deal on it and make progress for the American people. But all too often, you know, these issues where there actually is some consensus gets wrapped up in a larger political gamesmanship, and that leads to bad government.
Ballpark, do you have an idea if you could implement the findings from this cost-effectiveness research? How much would that, we're spending 16% of GDP right now on healthcare. How much would that go down just by making reasonable modifications based on that kind of research, do you guess?
You know, there were a host of things in the healthcare bill that have not been tried before very much. And this was one of them. There were other ones, accountable care organizations, electronic, you know, technology, you know, electronic records, comparative effectiveness research. The Congressional Budget Office basically said, we don't really know. They said, we think that some of these things might make a significant difference over time, but it's difficult to predict. What we can say is that virtually every system that does a better job of controlling healthcare costs make some kind of decisions about reimbursement. Now, some of those systems make those decisions based on research, and some make it based on just government fiat, right? And the reality is, even in other countries where the government is powerful and they have bureaus to do some of these decisions, even there, the research is not always as good as you would want. What is unusual and what makes the United States unique is virtually every system in the world has somebody, because they're a more centralized system, saying to somebody else, you can't have this, and we just don't have that. And that goes back to the way in which, for understandable reasons, our laws were written. The Medicare law itself was written in a way to get support from doctors' groups. Medicare in 1965 was a very controversial law. There was, as many of you remember, accusations of socialized medicine and all sorts of things. And the accommodation was that the government made was, this is just insurance. We are just going to defer to doctors whatever their judgment is. Whatever is reasonable and necessary that a doctor says, we will pay for. And of course, that was inviting, as soon as you're inviting taxpayer money to pay for something without anybody having any capacity to say, we're going to make some decisions, It's an invitation to this problem. So the answer is I don't know, but what I do know is there's no way to control costs without changing the economic incentives and saying no to somebody. And I sure would rather have somebody making those decisions informed by research than just by their political preferences. Yep.
My question is how are these figures arrived at? About how much medical care costs. I'm thinking, for example, that our son had a procedure that cost, he was in the hospital for 4 hours, it was $17,000. We have insurance, so we paid, minor percentage of that. So is this accounted for as a $17,000 expense when we're talking about all these numbers, or is it an $800 expense?
No, this is talking about the overall cost.
I mean, what's the cost? You know, they charged us $17,000,
no,
but nobody paid that. No one paid that. Insurance didn't pay it. We didn't pay it. No one paid it.
Well, sometimes you have to always distinguish between, there is no free lunch. Somebody's paying for it somewhere along the line. Maybe there was a number that they never expected to get, and it was a mythical number, the hospital bill, when they were only hoping to collect X percentage of it. That could be. But it could be paid for by, who could pay for it? It could be paid for by the individual in a copay or premium of some kind. It could be paid by the insurance company. It could be paid for by government in the form of taxpayer dollars for Medicare and Medicaid. It could be paid for by another patient. Right? We have a lot of cross-subsidization. A particular patient might come in, and they and their insurer are only paying a certain amount, but this other surgery is, not so profitable that it's providing money to the hospital to cross-subsidize another patient. What this is trying to say is the overall cost in the system, and there are experts who try to calculate those things, but the connection between what those figures are and what anybody is paying in any different case, it can be very difficult to draw those lines.
Yeah, and if we hadn't had insurance, we actually would have had to pay the $17,000, but luckily we didn't, so, it's crazy.
Yeah,
enough of that.
But I think the larger point that you would make is, why is it so difficult to get the American public's attention on this cost problem? And there's two main reasons. One is, for most people, the costs are invisible. You don't see it. Think of your kids who are in their 30s or 40s. How many times have they called you and said, I would have gotten a 3% raise last year as opposed to a 1% raise except for the healthcare cost problem? They don't say that because they don't think that way. So one way, it's invisible. The second way is, you always have to remember, costs are income to somebody else. What we can consider costs is the doctor's income, is the hospital's income. So they have a benefit to protect those costs. They don't view them as costs. That's their income, right? It's a good thing for them.
I understand that one of the problems that we have in determining the comparative costs here is that we don't keep medical records by illness. We keep them by procedure, and they're scattered among the hospital, the doctor, the person that reads the x-rays, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder how you go about, I understand there are only one or two studies that have been done in the United States that are really looking at the total cost of a particular ailment rather than...
Yeah. We have a very decentralized system, and our system is set up in a way that makes it very hard to learn about the costs of illnesses or what works best. Interestingly, parts of the medical system that have been most effective in trying to figure these things out are the ones where the doctors and the nurses and the insurance is all sort of bundled together under one roof. And one part of our system that has been, and it may be for some of you have a different sort of connotation because it's changed so much, is the VA. The Veterans Administration has improved dramatically over the last 30, 40 years. And they are doing some very innovative things. And in fact, the knee surgery study was done at the VA. And the Cleveland Clinic and some of the Kaisers, where it's a more integrated system, they have been able to produce some information. But when you're in the typical system that we're all in, it's very hard to figure this stuff out. You're right.
Yeah. I guess I'm going to take the other side. I'm a physician that's been in practice for 30 years. And dealing with Medicare and Medicaid, it was a nightmare. I had a three-man practice, and I had five insurance clerks that did nothing but this over and over and over.
Right.
And probably maybe 10% of the patients that were coming in shouldn't have been coming in anyhow under Medicaid.
And is it Medicaid or Medicare?
Under Medicaid, yes. Because when something's free, they're going to come in
yep.
and take advantage of this. And you're bringing in 34 million more people under Medicaid. What I'm afraid of is, will this discourage doctors from going into medicine because it's going to be a shortage of doctors?
Yep.
They will not want to go into the profession.
That's
real.
Yeah. Oh, I think it is real. And one of the things, I don't have the statistics handy, but I should, is we spend a lot more than other countries on medicine. It's not because we're seeing doctors a lot more. We don't actually have, you know, a tremendous number of doctors. We probably have too few doctors. We're spending more not because of doctors per se, it's because of more drugs and treatments and interventions and MRIs and those other things. So we have problems with, we have doctor shortages, and the idea that increased insurance coverage is going to increase enrollment and is going to lead to more demand on the medical system that could increase faster than the supply of doctors, I think is a totally reasonable concern.
Can I get your take on the rationalization for mandatory care? We're going crazy now trying to see if the Commerce Clause, which doesn't have anything to do with inactivity, or the Necessary and Proper Clause, which is going to be hard to fit. But will the equal protection in the 14th Amendment protect us in this way? Currently, UVA is a good example. The hospital there is a perfect example. Charging $250,000 for an operation that costs $75,000 to be able to take care of those people that wind up in the emergency room that have no insurance and no coverage at all. The people that are paying for this are essentially the people that have insurance and that are using the hospital. The people who are getting away scot-free from this are the 25 to 45-year-olds who have no insurance and are not using the hospital. Can the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment be used to say, wait a second, we need equal protection here to protect us from a group of youngsters who don't have insurance, don't think they need insurance, and are never visiting the hospital, so consequently are not paying for an expensive operation?
I shouldn't wade into this. However, so I'm not a lawyer, but let me just say this in response, and that is by not so much answering the question, but by fleshing out why it's such an interesting one. And that is, what is at the heart of this debate? The debate about the healthcare bill, the most unpopular provision is the individual mandate. And it's interesting, of course, to remember how we got to an individual mandate. The individual mandate actually was originally a Republican idea. It was an effort by conservative economists who did not want to see a public health insurance system for all. They did not want a universal Medicare system like they have in Europe. And so what economists care about are people who game systems. And so the argument was, we've got all these people who are not contributing to the healthcare system, they're not paying in, but then they're going to expect healthcare services when they're sick, and they're free riding on the backs of everybody else, and that doesn't seem very fair. Why should they be free riding on our backs and expect to show up and get the hundreds of thousands of dollars at the emergency room that we're paying for when they don't even pay their insurance premiums? So they came up with the idea of, we should say, you can't do that. You can't free ride on the rest of us. You need to pay in. And so it was actually a response to try to block a public for all universal system like they have in Europe, that was going to be the mandate. Now we've come to the current situation where the mandate is at the heart of the bill. The mandate is, exactly as the questioner sort of said, it's an effort to get into the system the relatively healthy people who could pay for everybody else so that we're kind of collectivizing these risks. And the argument is, we need to do this because if we don't have a mandate, well, people will sort of not buy insurance until the moment before they're sick. Well, that doesn't seem very fair. You know, it's like sort of not buying fire insurance until your house is on fire, and then you say, here's my month's premium. I mean, the insurance company's not going to want to help you if you've never paid your insurance premiums until your house is actually on fire. And so it's really a way, it's a kind of tax. That's what it is, really. It's a tax. But the administration politically felt they couldn't call it a tax because they couldn't say what it was, and so they've called it a mandate. But the words matter in politics, and so now it is seen as not a tax. It's seen as a mandate, and we don't know whether this is constitutional. The only thing I know is that he may be, you know, right or wrong, but, you know, when Larry Tribe writes something in the New York Times and is able to predict for sure what the Supreme Court is going to rule, which he did this week, I don't think anybody knows. I don't think we know. I certainly don't know. If you told me, you know, a year from now that the bill was upheld, I'd believe you. And if you told me it was thrown out, I'd also believe you. This is going to be, I think, a closely argued case, and we don't know what will happen.
You've kind of moved into the area that I was originally going to ask about, but Lawrence Tribe weighed in just yesterday on this issue of the mandate.
Yep.
And basically, instead of drawing the parallel to the fire insurance, which a lot of us have been talking about, drew the parallel to Social Security, which, of course, is a tax.
Yes.
And so you're getting into this this terminology and what you're going to choose, because if everyone had the option not to contribute to Social Security, saying, I don't want it because I'm not going to need it, the whole system would unravel.
That's right.
And so the foundation for the success of this particular health care plan rests on that mandate. Otherwise, it's not going to be able to be financially supported.
Yeah.
But what I was originally going to be thinking about was the question, to what extent, when you're talking about the cost of health care here, includes or not all of the premiums that go into the insurance companies and all of the administrative costs in the physician's offices, whether it be through Medicare or through private health insurance, that are there now as part of the system, and comparing it to the European systems where apparently they're having better outcomes at much lower cost. And of course, people will argue whether that's the case or not, and then you get into the question of access and rationing back to where you began.
Well, part of the reason our system does cost so much is we have a much more complex system than other countries, and we have all these administrative costs and insurance costs. And that is no doubt part of it. And if we somehow eliminated that, that would help. But I don't think that's the main driver. The main driver is we are consuming more stuff, and the stuff costs more. Because in European countries, they regulate the prices. Now, price regulation is very double-edged, right? It creates all sorts of distorted effects. And it's also the case that they may be free-riding on us, because if we are overpaying for drugs, but some of that money is going into the development of new pharmaceuticals, they're benefiting from, right? So it's actually extremely complicated. They are probably also not paying the full cost because we're paying too much in some ways. The Social Security example is interesting because, you know, making big public policy changes, it's always a matter of what's good policy, what's legal, what's politically feasible. So back in Social Security, what they really wanted to do was sell Social Security as social insurance, that you are somehow contributing for your own retirement. But they were worried back in 1935 that there was nothing in the Constitution that said the federal government could create such a program. So they were very strategic, and they said, even though that was their rhetoric, what they did in writing the bill was they said, oh, we're not creating a social insurance program, we're creating two programs, a tax program, that's the payroll tax, and then a spending program, that's the spending side. And, you know, these things really are very separate, because they knew that the court would uphold a tax and a court would uphold a spending program. Here, in this case, what they really wanted to do was create a tax, because they knew legally they could do that. The court would have upheld it if it were a tax, but in the current politics, they felt that they couldn't even write it that way or else be vulnerable, and so it ended up more convoluted.
I'm confused about the number of companies and different types of organizations just about on a daily basis are being allowed to opt out of Obamacare. Can you speak to that?
Oh, about different companies that are being allowed to... I guess there are different... I'm not an expert on all the rules and regulations about that, but there are some about what size of the firms that you have to be captured by the system and whether you self-insure or not. And there's some ambiguity about around those rules and some effort politically not to create any burdens on firms and also not to cause firms to drop their existing coverage and throw people into the other system. And so the Obama administration politically trying to build support for this while the bill is still very fragile has been wanting to be on the more accommodating side and not to create headlines about sort of negative effects in the first couple of years about firms that are saying, well, we can't offer our health insurance anymore. And so, you know, when firms are looking for various waivers and rules to make it possible either for them to comply with the rules or to keep doing what they're doing, they've been on that side.
Professor Potashnik, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.